The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Robert J. Steigman presiding.
Thank you, Mr. Bailiff. Our case this afternoon for oral argument is 425-1383, Withers versus Byron Community Unit School District 226 et al. And I'll ask the counsel to please state your name, starting with the appellate counsel. Please state your name, sir.
Patrick Anderson for Shane Withers.
Thank you. And counsel for the appellate.
Kevin Knoll for Appley.
Thank you, counsel. Then, Mr. Anderson, on behalf of the appellant, you may begin your argument at this time, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, your honors, opposing counsel. Again, my name is Pat Anderson. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Shane Withers. We are asking the court to reverse the decision of the trial court to grant summary judgment in defendant's favor based on the Illinois Tort Immunity Act. And I won't belabor the details, but the case involves a high school student who was sexually assaulted and filmed on a football team bus with four coaches who were charged with supervision sitting just feet away. And this came after years of documented targeting of Shane by the assailant that the defendants knew about. Today, I intend to address two primary points. Is first, the issue of whether the defendant's failure to supervise on the bus was willful and wanton is a disputed question of fact that should be submitted to the jury. The second issue I intend to discuss is the discretionary immunity issue. And I will discuss that discretionary immunity does not apply for three independent reasons, as they were laid out in the briefs. And then, time permitting, I'll discuss a third area, which is the treatment of the evidence of incidents between Shane and the assailant, Ricky Messling, leading up to the bus incident. But in discussing those areas, it is vital to keep in mind that this is a summary judgment appeal. So the question is not whether a jury could, or the question is whether a jury could find for Shane and not whether it should. And on this record, it clearly could. So,
Counsel, I have a question for you. Go ahead.
After you, Justice Steigman.
Okay. Thank you, Justice Zinoff. My question is my understanding correct that the plaintiff turned 18 on September 12, 2018?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. Yes.
Does that mean then he had until September 12, 2019 file suit as to the incidents of willful and wanton supervision occurring before he turned 18?
Before he turned 18, that's correct, Your Honor. However, the bus incident occurred on November 19th, and he filed less than 1 year later, I believe. I'm sorry, he filed on November 19th. The bus incident happened November 23rd. So under any analysis, the bus incident falls within was timely filed.
Well, it would be correct then that 10 incidents of alleged willful and wanton supervision occurring before plaintiff turned 18 are time barred.
Well, Your Honor, that is the third issue I was going to get into is the treatment of those particular incidences. In the context of the wrongful supervision claim that is being pursued, the incident that caused injury to Shane was the sexual assault on the bus. The other 10 incidents that we discuss in our brief and are written out there are borne out in the complaint. Those are incidents that should have given the defendant notice of the impending danger to Shane. This history between them informs the willful and wanton conduct claim on that bus. And so, while they may not be independent tort claims, each of those incidents of bullying or targeting leading up to it, there's a 10-year history, or a multiple-year history going back to fourth grade between these two. And the evidence
Well,
shows
counsel, if
that.
I can just interrupt on this point this afternoon. So, in your brief, you talk about the continuing tort theory with respect to these incidents that you were just enumerating or referring to. But tell us, how does that continuing tort theory apply to save these incidents other than the bus incident we were talking about, those prior to the bus, when the actors in some of them were different? The type of injuries allegedly sustained weren't similar. Those are two elements or factors that need to be there if we are to apply or look at a continuing tort theory and tell us where they are here.
Understood, Your Honor. And the continuing tort theory is really a secondary argument because the focus of this appeal is the wrongful supervision claim in isolation. That claim is the claim that gave rise to that caused the injuries, that gives rise to the claim, that the November bus incident. These other 10 incidents, in the context of the supervision claim, provide a basis for what the defendants knew or should have known. And based on those incidents, based on what the defendants knew or should have known, a reasonable jury could find that the failure to supervise on the bus was willful and wanton. The
How
continuing
could they
tort.
have known? But counsel, excuse me for interrupting. How could they have known if there were different people involved? I mean, not all of these incidents, and if you look at the depositions, involved the same people, those two young men.
Well, understood, but Shane testified that he reported all of these incidents to school administrators. And so, whether the coaches should have known or knew or should have known is a question of fact, given what Shane reported to anyone that would listen. There's also evidence that the coaches knew about this targeting. Shane said that the coaches were aware of the conflicts between he and Messling going back years. And so that goes to what the coaches knew or should have known. And the way the continuing tort theory came up is this initially arose in a motion to dismiss. And the prior motion judge denied the motion to dismiss on the statute of limitations grounds on the prior incidents based on that continuing tort theory. So that argument has carried through. However, we've now narrowed the issue on this appeal to this discrete supervision issue on the school bus. And in that context, the evidence is proof of notice or proof of what defendants knew or should have known, which is what elevates their conduct from mere negligence to willful and wanton conduct, or at least creates a jury question to that effect. So that's how that evidence fits into our current claim as it sits now, relating to supervision and that discrete incident on the bus. And so, with the inferences must be that have to be drawn in Shane's favor, a reasonable jury could find that the defendants knew or should have known of an impending danger to Shane, and that their failure to act constitutes conscious disregard or utter indifference, which satisfies the unintentional, willful, and wanton standard. So that is our theory. That is how the prior incidents fit into that theory now. So, with or without the continuing tort theory, those prior incidents are relevant to the supervision claim as it relates to the bus incident. And so, in this case, the trial court did what the summary judgment rules forbid. It weighed evidence, it resolved inferences against Shane, and took two questions from the jury that Illinois law commits to the finder of fact, which is one, whether the failure to supervise was merely negligent or whether it rose to the level of willful and wanton conduct. And the second issue is whether the defendants made any decision at all on the bus, let alone a discretionary one. And when there's a question of fact as to whether a decision was made or whether it was discretionary, that is a precludes summary judgment. It's a question that goes to the jury. And so, on this record, a jury could find that the coaches consciously disregarded a known danger that Messling targeted him for years, and that Messling ultimately sexually assaulted him just feet from four coaches on a bus. And the bus incident, or the bus driver, also testified that he heard a commotion. Whether that is negligence under these circumstances or rises to willful and wanton conduct is a classic jury question. The case is similar to the Supreme Court's decision in Ortega Piron, which was cited in the briefs, 213 Illinois 2nd 19. That was a case where a special needs student was sexually assaulted by another student on a school bus. The court found that prior knowledge of the assailant's propensity for violence presented a jury question about knowledge and foreseeability. And they found that the failure to protect, a reasonable jury could find that to be willful and wanton. In this case, Shane's years of documented targeting by Messling present the same jury question. The same was true in the Gammon case, Gammon. A student reported specific threats, and the court found the willful and wanton question was for the jury because of this past history that the defendant knew or should have known about. And so, again, because this is a summary judgment case, every inference goes to Shane. And we acknowledge there's conflicting evidence that Shane and Messling may have been friendly, that Shane was sometimes an instigator, and that the coaches deny hearing anything on the bus. But conceding a conflict exists is conceding a trial is required, because on summary judgment, those conflicts have to be resolved in Shane's favor. We know that this was at least negligence, because no student should be able to be sexually assaulted on a team bus by another student while there are four coaches in close quarters, and those coaches are charged with supervision. So we know it was at least negligent, because this can't happen if it's not negligent. But under these facts, with all of the other things that we have in this case and all of the history that we have between these two, the question of whether it is willful and wanton or whether it's just negligence, that's a jury question. And that is what our courts have drawn the line and said, hey, it's not for the courts to draw this line. That's not a question of law. Where the line falls, given a particular set of facts, is for the jury. And that's how it should be in this case. And so I'll move on now to the discretionary immunity aspect. Discretionary immunity under Section 2-201 does not shield defendant from liability in this case for three reasons. The first reason is that because 2-201 is a general immunity provision, and where there are two statutory provisions, one is general and one is specific, the specific applies over the general. The Supreme Court's decision in Murray, sorry, do you have a question?
Well, I was going to ask with respect to 3108A, how does it apply here at all? Whether or not it's more specific, doesn't immunity attach when injuries happen on public property? And where did this injury happen? On public property?
It occurred on a school bus.
And school bus is public property?
It was being operated by the... I'm sorry. No, I'm sorry. It was being operated by the public entity. We have cited cases in the briefs where this section has been applied to schools, and I believe it has been applied on a bus. The Reyes case, where the bus supervisor fell asleep. The Ortega Perone case.
That's a different point, whether she fell asleep or not. We can talk about that in a minute. But this bus was chartered, was it not? And it was owned by a private company, not by the school district, at least as I saw the record. But is there something else in the record that would indicate that it was public property as opposed to private property?
Well, it was being used for a municipal function. It was being used for a school function. It was chartered for a school purpose. It was being used by the school for a football team
for transportation.
And so I think the logic and reasoning of the statute extends to that same thing. I mean, essentially, this was property that they had adopted, that they're still charged with. I don't think anybody denies that the coaches had responsibility for supervising these students on the bus. They admit it. They are in charge of supervising it the same way any other teacher. And so it's our position that Section 3-108 governs, because it applies to the specific function at issue, which is the supervision by a municipal entity. And
Counsel,
so that's
do you have any authority for the position that the leasing of the bus by the school makes it public property?
You know, I don't, but I just think it would be incongruous and inconsistent with the law to say that a school's failure to supervise the students on the bus would be subject to immunity as long as the bus is in the parking lot. But once it leaves, you know, the provision does not apply. I think that is
it's not
incongruous.
It's not public property.
I think they adopted it as essentially quasi public property by using it for this purpose. They're using it for a municipal purpose. And so I would take the position that the bus was being operated as public property at that time. Even absent the general versus specific distinction, the second reason that the discretionary immunity does not apply is because the defendants have denied that they knew this assault was ongoing on the bus. And for discretionary immunity to apply, the defendants must prove that there was a discretionary decision. And inherent in a discretionary decision is that there was a decision at all. And we cited Andrews and Monson in the briefs, and they indicate that if there is no knowledge of the actual condition or the act that caused, that is alleged to have caused the plaintiff's injury, then there can't have been any sort of decision. In this case,
The decision was the coach decided who was going to ride on the bus. He had the varsity football team ride together on the bus. The varsity coaches rode with them, correct? So how was that not a discretionary decision? There was also information in the handbooks about the behavior that needed to be followed on the bus and by the team members. Why were not these factors important here?
well, because those didn't have anything to do with the decision to intervene or not intervene in the sexual assault that was ongoing. That is the conduct that's alleged to have caused the injury. The defendants say, we didn't know this was ongoing. And so what we're saying is the negligence is the failure to intervene to stop this sexual assault. If you didn't know the sexual assault is going on, then the failure to intervene was a decision by default. It's because you didn't know it was happening, not because you saw it and decided to take a certain course of action that resulted in other events. They didn't make any po conscious policy decision to allow this sexual assault on the bus. That is the salient issue that needs to have discretion, that they made discretionary decisions with respect to other things that didn't lead to this injury. That does not provide them immunity. What the decision needs to be is with respect to the allegation, what is alleged to have caused plaintiff's injury. And in this case, that's the sexual assault on the bus. Because the defendants claim that they didn't know anything was going on, they can't possibly have made a decision not to intervene. Their failure to intervene.
You're limiting the term discretionary decision to the criminal act of a third party itself. That's the limit of your reference to a discretionary decision, is that right?
Well, I think that reframing the issue in terms of the assailant instead of the defendant's duties, and they acknowledge their duty to supervise. And so under that, like we was talking about before, is that this is at least negligence. But they made no decision at all because they claim they
Well,
didn't know what was going
the point
on.
of the question is you are limiting to the use you're limiting the use of the term discretionary decision to the act itself.
Yeah, and that's
No
what
other
our.
discretionary decisions are relevant.
Not if those are not the discretionary decisions, not if those were not decisions related to the act that was alleged to have caused the injury,
Well,
that
but
they
they're all
made.
related. Just as Justice Zinoff indicated, the coaches decide who's going to ride on which buses. They decide which coaches are going to be there. They decide that the players can determine where they want to sit. That's a decision. They could have said, no, you all sit alphabetically or you sit
Right.
by grade. They've made a discretionary decision that they can sit wherever they want to sit. They've made the discretionary decision that they're going to walk the aisles on occasion to make sure that everything's okay. Those are all discretionary decisions, but you're saying since they don't relate directly to the act, they're not relevant discretionary decisions. Is that my understanding?
They're not decisions that entitle defendant to immunity such that summary judgment is appropriate. Plaintiff doesn't allege
That
that they were
wasn't the
negligent.
question, but go ahead.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Go ahead.
The plaintiff didn't allege that the negligence was telling them to sit in the wrong seats or doing the wrong seat assignments. The negligence is failing to stop the sexual assault. If they don't know anything's going on, that's the incident that caused plaintiff's injury. And under Andrews and Monson, that's the incident that needs to have discretion attached to it. And that's our argument, is that it doesn't. And so our final argument with respect to the discretionary immunity aspect is that there was no determination of policy, that this was not unique to a particular public office. The coaches testified that they supervised the bus the same way any other teacher or coach or administrator would. And so this is not unique to a public office. There's also no evidence of balancing competing interests. There's no evidence that the coaches weighed any competing interests in terms of deciding to allow a sexual assault on the bus. There is no policy interest that would protect that activity anyway. The coaches admit they had no role in discipline and needed no policy to know how to supervise the bus. And so that's a ministerial act, not a discretionary one. So for that third additional reason, discretionary immunity does not apply. I will wrap up just to say in closing, summary judgment is not a substitute for trial. It's a screening tool to determine if trial is needed. And under the facts of this case, the questions of fact exist with respect to whether the conduct was negligent or merely willful and wanton, or whether it reflected any discretionary choice. Those are questions of fact that Illinois law commits to a jury. So we would ask this court to reverse the decision of the trial court to grant summary judgment. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. You will have an opportunity to address us against in rebuttal. At this time, Mr. Noll, on behalf of the appellee, you may make your argument.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Kevin Noll, counsel for Byron Community Unit School District 226 and the district employees named in their official capacities. The circuit court granted summary judgment on three independent grounds: the statute of limitations, section 2201 discretionary immunity, and the absence of any evidence of willful and wanton conduct. This appeal today does not dislodge any of these grounds. It simply tries to shrink the case down to a single moment on a bus to escape discretionary immunity, while at the same time expanding the case to try to prove foreseeability. Withers cannot have it both ways. Illinois law gives school employees absolute immunity for the discretionary judgments they make in responding to student conflict and keeping students safe. And nothing in this record takes the district defendant's conduct outside of this fundamental protection. I will make three points today. First, the district defendants are absolutely immune under section 2201, often referred to as discretionary immunity, and section 3108 does not supersede or displace that immunity. Second, there is absolutely no evidence of willful and wanton conduct. And third, the pre-November 2018 incidents are time barred, and Withers' own reframing of them defeats his appeal on those issues. Point one, the district defendants are absolutely immune under section 2201. The district defendants are entitled to absolute immunity because they held discretionary positions and their acts and omissions were determinations of policy and exercises of discretion. Our courts have long established that school districts, when addressing student conflict, disciplinary matters, and bullying allegations, are immune under section 2201 of the Tort Immunity Act. School officials
address— Excuse me, I have a question concerning that. How do you respond to opposing counsel's argument that the discretion applies or needs to apply to the act itself?
I would respond to that by arguing the act or omission that is allegedly giving rise to the injury is beyond the seconds of the sexual assault in the school bus, but the acts or omissions giving rise are the school officials, the school employees' response to the history of student conflict involving Shane Withers, other students, including Ricky Messling. So it's when we're talking about the act or omission, we're not looking at that 10-second moment in time in which the sexual assault occurred, but the acts or omissions that are relevant to the school employees go beyond that, those 10 seconds, beyond the bus ride itself, but in the discretionary acts in addressing student conflict issues as alleged in the Second Amendment complaint. And these judgment calls in addressing these types of student conflict issues is exactly what Section 2201 is designed to protect. It's premised on the principle that public employees need to exercise their judgment in rendering decisions without fear that a mistake might subject them to liability, or in this case, a criminal act by a student might subject them to liability. Mr. Mullins, who is the school principal, Mr. Manzin, the assistant principal, Coach Boyer, who was a teacher and the head coach, and Sean Considine, who was a coach, and Jim Kahn, the athletic director, all hold positions involving the exercise of discretion. And the record in this case shows deliberate, individualized judgment by all of these folks. Manzin and Mullins addressed the student conflict issues head on over the years as the principal and the assistant principal. They testified that they consulted the discipline matrix when addressing student conflict. They weighed each student's history, the severity of the conduct, and then they decided on the appropriate response after meeting with students and taking feedback from teachers. The Oreo cookie run, which is discussed throughout the briefs, prompted an immediate fact-driven investigation by Mullins, Manzin, and Kahn. And then Boyer and Considine, the football coaches, knowing that Withers and Messling were friends, made a judgment call that there was no need to separate them on the bus, which this is the same kind of discretion that's talked about in the DM case that is cited throughout the district defendant's brief. Now, what Withers is doing with this appeal is trying to narrow it so that we're only focusing on the coach's supervision on the bus in a very brief moment of time. But as I said, he can't narrow his way around all of the discretionary decisions leading up to that point.
Well, but his argument was that the staff, the coaches, should have known what the history was between the two of them, and certainly by implication taken measures to either separate them or make sure that there wasn't an incident, an untoward incident that happened. That's what I understood the argument to be.
And in doing that, in knowing that history between Shane Withers and Ricky Messling, in which there was some history, but I would submit not to the extent that is pled in the second amended complaint, but that history, those school administrators are allowed to make their judgment call on what to do or what not to do, whether to separate them on the bus or whether not to separate them on the bus. That is the decision-making process. They're entitled to make a mistake under Section 2201. Turning now briefly to Withers' argument about the Section 3108 supervision immunity, and that because it is a more specific provision, it should govern, I would submit that that argument fails. Withers relies heavily on the Murray case cited throughout his brief. And that case found that Section 2201 discretionary immunity was essentially superseded by Section 3109 in a issue that involved an injury while trampolining, a physical injury on a trampoline. Now, why the Murray case can easily be distinguished is because Section 3109, which is the more specific provision, is titled Hazardous Recreation Activity. And in the definition in the Tort Immunity Act of hazardous recreational activity, you find trampolining. So in that case, it no doubt is the more specific provision. That's not what we have here. As I was alluding to before, what we're talking about, the acts or omissions, is not limited to a small supervision issue in a very short moment of time, but rather decision-making, addressing student conflict, meeting with students, meeting with teachers, that is talked about in kind of the long extended history in the case.
But now, counsel, that provision says, except as otherwise provided, neither a local public entity nor a public employee who undertakes to supervise an activity on or the use of any public property is liable for the injury, et cetera. We'll go back to the question of, was this bus public property?
Right. And I think the court makes a good point that this was a private chartered bus. And for that reason, I would submit we should be looking at 2201 and not 3108. But the overarching argument is that supervision is not direct, does not directly address the conduct that we're talking about here. The conduct that we're talking about is broader than supervision. We're talking about discretionary decision making and how school officials respond to student conflict, maintain school safety, and take disciplinary or decide to take disciplinary measures when appropriate. That is well beyond what supervision is. And all of that that I just mentioned requires deliberation and judgment beyond supervision, placing these facts squarely within Section 2201. Withers' argument is dispelled by Illinois courts that have repeatedly applied 2201 to decisions related to student conduct, discipline, and school safety. And for those reasons, I would submit that 2201 is the controlling provision. Point two is there is simply no evidence of willful and wanton conduct in this record. So even if immunity did not apply, summary judgment stands because there is no evidence that the district and district defendants engaged in a course of action showing deliberate intent to harm or conscious disregard for Withers' welfare. The record simply does not support the inflammatory allegations in the Second Amended complaint, and in fact, often contradicts them. The actual evidence in the record is that Withers and Mesling were friends, and there's testimony on that from everybody except Shane Withers. The evidence in the record is that Boyer had no reason to anticipate that an assault would happen on that day. In fact, a teammate testified that the conduct on the bus, the sexual assault, never happened at Byron and at Byron before. Related to the Oreo cookie run, the evidence is the coaches had no advance knowledge of this happening. Withers admitted so much, despite what's pled in the Second Amended complaint, and the players testified on the steps that they took to conceal that activity from the coaches. And most of the prior student conflict incidents did not even involve Mesling, but involved other students. So willful and wanton conduct is aggravated negligence requiring either deliberate intent to harm or a conscious disregard. So Withers must show a conscious course of action with knowledge of serious danger or knowledge of facts disclosing that danger. There is no doubt that Messling's behavior on the bus was deplorable, but it was completely unforeseeable. And for that reason, we cannot hold the school employees, the coaches, and administrators liable under a willful and wanton theory. The circuit court got it right. Given the facts in the record, no reasonable jury could return a willful and wanton verdict for Withers. My final point is related to the statute of limitations issue. Section 8101A of the Tort Immunity Act simply bars every incident except the November 2018 bus incident. And Withers' attempt in this appeal to kind of repackage those incidents does not somehow revive them or cannot revive them to create liability on their own. Section 8101 requires suit against a local entity or its employees within 1 year. It applies broadly to any such claim. The suit was filed on November 21st of 2019, and that's more than a year after every incident except the bus incident. The continuing tort rule that was discussed briefly earlier does not apply. It's going to the that rule is going to require a continuous, unbroken course of conduct related to one wrong, not a bunch of discrete decisions. What we're talking about here are discrete decisions or discrete actions related to a variety of different students with completely separate and with no core nucleus of facts or even actors. So the continuing tort theory, which counsel admitted was a secondary argument, simply fails. In the reply and opening.
Why don't all these other incidents serve to give, why didn't they serve to give the school district staff notice of what the relationship really was? And so that they had the knowledge to take action prior to that bus ride. I mean, that's counsel reframed the argument here today in that fashion. Probably he did it a little more articulately than I did. But why should we not look at it with that lens?
And I agree with the court and counsel that those actions can be viewed in that lens. What I'm simply arguing is that in agreeing with the circuit court, those actions cannot be used independently to establish liability. Now, I do think those historic actions are very relevant because those relate to the discretionary decisions that the school officials made along the way. And in addressing all of that, and you see throughout the brief and the timeline of all these historic events, that all of the issues were addressed. They just weren't addressed in the way that plaintiff Shane Withers now wants them to have been addressed. It did not result in a decision by a school official saying that these two need to be separated at all times or on the bus ride home from the state championship game. But that's the judgment call that these school employees are allowed to make. And that's what Section 2201 discretionary immunity is all about, to provide these public officials some relief that if they get that judgment call wrong, that they won't be held liable.
Counsel, what about the fact that if the facts of these other incidences are in dispute and they're being used to determine the level of knowledge to which the school staff should have been put, why doesn't that create a genuine issue of material fact?
I don't believe it creates a genuine issue of material fact, because I actually think the evidence in the record does not show that there's a material difference between what Shane Withers is saying happened during these issues and what everybody else is saying. With a lot of these issues, there is what is pled in the second amended complaint, which is then contradicted by school employees' testimony and often contradicted by Shane Withers' testimony, who is admitting that in many of the situations that he was the instigator and that he was the one who engaged in misconduct as well. So I just don't feel that there is a material issue of fact on a lot of those issues.
So the difference isn't a question of fact, it's the difference between what the facts were and what's pled.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay, so I'll summarize by saying Illinois courts have consistently provided immunity to the discretionary judgments school employees make in responding to student conflict and keeping students safe. Withers asks this court to be the first to depart from that long line of cases and to do so on a record with no evidence of willful and wanton conduct. The circuit court correctly declined, and we ask that the judgment of the circuit court be affirmed. That's all I have.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Anderson, on behalf of the appellant, you have a rebuttal argument at this time, if you wish.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'd like to start with one of the last points counsel made, and I think he made the distinction. He said that the conflict isn't within the testimony, that it's between plaintiff's complaint and the testimony. There's a discrepancy. That I would submit that counsel's recounting of Shane's testimony, in which he allegedly admitted he was the instigator of many of these incidents or was at fault for many of these incidents, is at the very least an overstatement. In Shane's discovery deposition, each one of the incidents in the complaint were discussed with Shane, and he confirmed each one of those incidents. And so there is a conflict in the testimony. Shane affirmed each one of those incidents occurred. He affirmed that, you know, he was the victim in the majority of them, or at least that's the way he testified. But again, we acknowledge there are conflicts in the testimony. That is exactly why summary judgment is inappropriate. It's for the jury to decide who was the instigator. It's for the jury to decide whether these are enough. But I would submit
that's
that
all I have a question for you.
Yeah.
My question is regarding Boyer when he assigned Plaintiff and Messling to the same charter bus. Under the evidence in this record, doesn't it show that when Boyer did that, he was unaware of any problems between Plaintiff and Messling, and in fact believed that they were very good friends?
That's what he testified, but that is a conflict in the evidence.
Well, is there any evidence contradicting what he believed, that he said something else to somebody else?
Well, Shane testified that the coaches were well aware of the conflict between he and Messling. Now, whether that there is evidence to conflict is
what's that based on?
It's based on Shane's testimony. I mean, that is testimony that's evidence in the case that the administrators were aware and that the coaches were aware. So that's what Shane testified to. That's the evidence in the record. That's the conflict that the jury needs to decide. Another point I wanted to address was just the discussion about discretionary decisions about whether they needed to be separated before the bus ride. Those are different issues. Plaintiff doesn't allege that they should have been separated before the bus ride. Plaintiff alleges that the history gave these coaches on the bus reasonable notice that they needed to supervise that bus better. Not that anything should have been done before that. Not that how they handled this history was bad. It's whether with the knowledge they knew or should have known whether what they did or didn't do on that bus in supervising or failing to supervise was willful and wanton. And I'll just go back to the court.
But they testified that they walked up and down the aisle of the bus. What more could they have done? If you're conceding today that they shouldn't have separated them and prohibited them from sitting near each other, then how many is there, or do we draw a line? They needed to go up and down every 5 minutes or 10 times, or how do we look at this?
Well, what specifically they needed to do or not do is a question of breach, and that's for the jury to decide. Whether or not they should have acted differently, whether they should have simply been paying more attention. These facts gave them notice that this situation should have required their attention. Whether that meant they should have walked up and down more often, whether that meant they should have positioned a coach in the back of the bus, whether that meant they should have just been more attentive to those two while the bus ride was going on. The bus driver testified he noticed the commotion. The question of fact is, why didn't the coaches notice the same commotion? So those are conflicts in the evidence that preclude summary judgment. Those are what they needed to do to carry out their duty. That's for the jury to decide whether what they did exhibited utter indifference or conscious disregard. That's the question, and that's a question of fact for the jury to decide. So, and just to the discretionary point, finally, the Supreme Court in Andrews specifically stated that the act or omission giving rise to the injury must constitute both the exercise of discretion and the determination of policy. The court reiterated that the entity or person claiming immunity must have made an actual decision with respect to the acts or omissions giving rise to the injuries. And in this case, it's plaintiff's position that the acts giving rise to the injuries were those that occurred on that bus. The defendants had notice of a reason to increase their supervision on that bus. Whether they did or did not is a question of fact for the jury. We'd ask this court to reverse and allow the jury to decide the case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement, render decision in due course, and will now stand in recess in this case.